Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Once again, it's the I Thought I Was Proper Mental Podcast. Thank you very much for joining me. Today it is episode 14, and my guest today is Sharifa J. Sharifa is a model, a presenter, an influencer, and a campaigner. She's at the forefront of promoting body and race diversity in fashion, in advertising, and sort of in general life. She's a mental health advocate, and she's an ambassador for the Calm organization. She also runs a non-profit called Shine for Diversity, where she campaigns and highlights racial inclusion in advertising. Sharifa is an influencer, but that kind of, with all the connotations that come with that term, it doesn't really do her justice. She definitely uses her powers for good. And she talks about some really good things. She's involved in campaigning for some really good, important causes. And I really like how she uses her social media. I'm a big fan. We talk about it a bit in the episode. She's a really, really positive person, and she's very real. So on her socials, you know, if she's having a bad day, she'll tell you. If she's, if she's having like a bad skin day, then she'll talk about it. Or a bad hair day, she'll talk about it. You know, she shows both sides of the coin, which is rare. It's rare in social media in general. We're all quite bad for that. But it's particularly rare for someone who's a model, you know, for someone who's in the public eye, for someone who's got profile, to be that honest and that real. And I think that's why people like her so much. And we talk about a lot of really, really cool stuff. We talk about being proactive and not reactive when it comes to mental health. We talk about the modeling industry, and Sharifa kind of goes into her experiences behind the scenes and how certain aspects of that affected her mental health in the past. That was fascinating. I know nothing about what it's like to be a model, clearly. And so that was really cool to get inside of that. We also talk a lot about body positivity, because that's something that Sharifa promotes. You know, that's something she knows a lot about. And it's something I didn't know a great deal about. And I suppose with me having, as part of my day job, I kind of work on the outskirts of the fitness industry. Maybe I have one foot in that world, maybe. And there's a lot of talk in that world about obesity and weight and calories and food and all that sort of stuff. And body positivity has maybe been, I don't know, it feels like it might have been sort of hijacked a little bit to get likes and, to promote certain products that might not be entirely legit. So to get someone who's actually, you know, a part of that movement and at the front leading the cause, it was great. And I learned a lot. It was really interesting to speak to Sharifa. And it was fascinating for me. We talk about self-care. We talk about social media. We talk about life in general. And of course, we talk about mental health. And yeah, it's great. Sharifa was really, really lovely. I got on really, really well. And we just jumped on the call and started chatting. And it was only afterwards I thought, oh, crikey, I didn't even introduce her or anything. We just hit the ground running and just talked for an hour and then said goodbye. And it was wicked. It was really, really nice. And if you'd like to check in with Sharifa and have a look at her social media, I think Instagram's probably the best place to get hold of her. She is at Sharifa_J. And you can check out Shine for Diversity, which is her nonprofit. That's at Shine4, like a number 4, Diversity. If you want to follow me and the podcast, it's at Proper Mental Podcast on pretty much all platforms. If you haven't left me a review yet, then could you do so, please? That would be great. And the fundraiser's still going. So depending on when you're listening to this, this is due out on the 24th of May, 2021. And we've got a fundraiser going for My Black Dog. And it's £5 a ticket. And all our guests have chucked in some really like cool merch, books and t-shirts and all sorts of stuff. And we're raffling that off. So if you'd like to do that, all the links are in my bio on Instagram and Facebook, and you can go and have a chance of winning that. I'm going to draw it around about the end of the month or when there's enough money in the pot. And that's everything. I'm trying to keep my intros a bit shorter, so hopefully that's worked this week. So thank you for listening. As ever, please enjoy episode 14 of the Proper Mental Podcast with Sharifa J. Very thoughtful.
Thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm wicked, mate. Thank you. Yeah, I'm really good. Thank you for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
No worries at all. I might just like sit down here a bit. I feel a bit worse for wear today. I've got an ear infection and something's happened to my foot and I'm just like...
Oh, mate.
So I'm just feeling a little semi-broken, but...
Oh, well, yeah, hopefully it won't be too taxing for you, mate. Well,
Yeah.
Try and take care of it. Oh, how's things?
Yeah, good. Just like getting back to life, isn't it? Like it's really bizarre. I don't know if anyone else is feeling this, but we've gone from the most intense, I think the most intense lockdown was in like that January kind of period, the last one.
Yeah.
Where it was so cold and dark, and then those COVID numbers kept rising, and I think everyone was really feeling it on that one. And now it's like everything's opening back up again, and I feel like I've been thrown back into work headfirst, and from nothing, you know, from not having to wake up in the morning to like having to do so much stuff. So it's just been really odd. I don't know if you're feeling that as well.
Yeah, exactly the same. Yeah, it kind of feels to me like almost like water current, you know, and sometimes you feel like you're on a raft or something and it's starting to get a bit faster and you're thinking, oh, I'm not quite sure I'm like equipped to be sailing this type of sea. And yet you can't get off, you know, it's quite you know, I don't know. I'm enjoying it from a distance. So if I walk past the pub garden and I see all these people, I think, oh, that's, you know, that sound, that feeling in the air, isn't that nice? But if someone said to me, do you want to go sit in it? I'd be like, oh, I'm all right. Like, I'm not quite there yet.
That's possibly one of the best ways that you can do it at the beginning. Like my friend said, they got on the tube the other day and had a panic attack. And bless her, she's been shielding for the whole year because her mum has sickle cell anemia and her sister has special needs, so she's been shielding with them for the whole entire year. So I mean, literally, like, not hasn't gone to anything, has net but barely stepped out of her front door. And I think she's also become really terrified naturally of her mum and her sister getting ill, so it's really hard for her to get back to work. But she's an actor and she's starting to book these acting jobs, and they're like, can you come to Manchester and can you come to this theater? And she's like, well, I can, but I also can't.
Yeah.
I feel really, I really feel for people that have been in that situation, because even though it's been hard for us all, I think people shielding are really going to have a big shock to the system trying to get back to life.
Yeah. And there's not really been anything like proposed about that, you know, like in all the steps to coming back, it's very much like economy focused and all this sort of stuff, but no one's really sort of suggesting any ideas about how we're supposed to normalize. We weren't told how to lock down, and no one's helping us unlock again, you know.
Mental health support is like, it's absolutely shocking, and it makes me really quite angry, to be honest, because I don't know if you know, I'm an ambassador for the mental health charity Calm, and I've been working for them, I've been an ambassador for them for probably 2 years now, maybe over 2 years, and you know, I kind of hear all of their stats and all of their figures about how many people are phoning in, how many people are calling in, and people just really struggling in this whole entire year. And where's the support from the government? Where's the budget? Like, you know, they've got enough money to spend on Brexit. Why can't you put some of that money into mental health services so that people can actually cope? Because I'm terrified to see the figures, the statistics of suicide rates, because obviously I know that there's nothing been like released officially yet, but all of these mental health charities have reported an increase in all of their services, and they're really overwhelmed and obviously underfunded now because they haven't been able to fundraise for a whole year. But I just think, where are our government in helping people? I mean, I know we're helping people in one way by protecting the vulnerable from the coronavirus and protecting us all from the coronavirus, but there are other types of illnesses, not just the coronavirus, you know, like that are impacting us all. So
yeah,
shocking.
Yeah, very much so. It kind of feels like there might be, like, we'll realize the full effects of this stuff further down the line, and we won't necessarily be talking about the virus anymore. It'll almost be like, you know, the first wave of a new pandemic, which will be the mental side effect. And I think as well, like, I see it in my kids. I've got two little ones that, you know, are in and out of school and nursery and stuff like that, and they're not, you know, they're not as keen to go back to like the little play groups and the things like that, you know. They just haven't, they've lost that, they were just learning them skills, and those skills have already been sort of paused. So
I really feel for kids as well. Like, I can't even imagine what must be going on in their little heads. They don't understand things, or we don't understand it. I mean, how are they gonna learn to understand it, you know? I think one of the strangest things that happened to me, I think it was last year, and it's all rolling into one. In between, I think it was the first and second lockdown, and we were kind of allowed out a little bit. And me and my friends went and sat in Regent's Park and had a picnic. And these little kids were running around, two girls, I think one boy, and they must have been like 3 or 4 years old. And one of the little girls ran up to our picnic blanket and was like, hello. And then her little friend was like, no, stop, social distance, and was really like, but the little girl was having, the one was trying to protect her friends, was having like a proper little breakdown. And she was like, just please stop touching everyone, stop running around. And I really felt for her because, yeah, she doesn't understand why, but she was just trying to do what she'd been told. And obviously, because there is so much conflicting information as well, like, I think kids just don't really know what to do and how to behave anymore.
Yeah, definitely. It's, you know, there's certain words that you're just not used to hearing from like little mouths as well, like social distancing. It's almost quite shocking when you hear someone quite, you know, quite small saying something like that. But yeah, like, so what they...
You know what? She might have said like distance. She might not have said like social distancing 2.2 meters apart, just so you know, wear your mask. Like, she was really quite small, but she did say something. Yeah.
She was there with a Fisher Price tape measure checking the distance between everyone. Yeah.
Boris Johnson said.
Yeah. So you mentioned your work with Calm, Sharifa. So what is it you do? Is it like an awareness thing you do for them, you know, spreading the word?
Yeah, so I mean, it's hard to say really what I do with them, but I just get involved in all of their, well, as many of their projects that they've got coming up where I can, to help spread the word, to help fundraise, to help raise awareness about suicide prevention, you know, destigmatizing the conversation around mental health. Because as much as I think we would all like to think that we can openly discuss these things, I think we really can't. We're still in a place where I think a lot of people don't feel comfortable talking about their own mental health, or questioning their friends or family about their mental health and investigating. And as we know, you know, suicide is the biggest killer of men under the age of 45 in the UK, which is shocking. And I can still never get my head around that number, but also the increasing, that there's a new trend with young women as well. I think it's, I don't remember the exact statistic, I could send it to you, but young women between the age of 10 and 24, there's been an increase in suicides.
In
young women as well. So I really feel like it's something that we all need to be talking about. And how I initially got started with them is I was posting this thing on my Instagram. It was called, I think it was about 2.5 years ago now, it was called You Okay, Hun? So every day I would say how I was feeling, to encourage other people to then tell me how they were feeling. So doesn't matter what day it was, come rain or shine, it would be like, today, this is what happened, this is how I'm feeling. And the response was really overwhelming. And I had men and women you know, all kinds of people messaging me and telling me about their mental health. And then I kind of realized, as much as I love talking about this, I don't have any, I don't have any credentials. I'm just a model and an influencer and a presenter, and that's I don't have any like credentials to be actually legitimately talking about this. So that's when I approached Calm and I said, I really want to speak more about this, but it's nice to have the kind of the backing and the support of a big charity like Calm, who are absolutely amazing. Because if I ever have any questions, I'm just like, what's the statistic on this? Or what's the thing there? So I know that I'm putting out the right information. And so I can also signpost people to a charity and understand their services really well. So I've done a few things for them. I was set to run the London Marathon actually last year, and I was going to fundraise for them, but obviously it got cancelled. So this year I'll be running the London Marathon again. Well, first time, but this time I'm hopefully it all goes ahead. Even if it doesn't all go ahead as planned, I'm still running my marathon because I started training for it. So I'll be fundraising for Calm again. Again, you know, it's not just about the money for me. It's really about spreading the awareness.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, like you say, it is important as well to have that that organization to send people towards, or to, you know, to have that backup. Because I think in this, you know, it's great that everyone's talking. It's great that we're trying to raise awareness and stuff like that. But, you know, you have to be able to do something with it, because I'm getting my words a bit muddled here, but I think it's very important to talk, and we need to encourage people to talk, but we never talk about how hard it is to talk. It's very easy to say, let's talk. And then when you find the courage to speak up and you kind of think, oh, you know, I feel better for this, now what? Then we need to be able to like point people in these directions where they can go and actually take the next step, because, you know, talking without action essentially is just talk as well, isn't it? You know, if people need to get some help, talking's a good first step, but we need to keep going, right? We need to move past that.
There's an amazing influencer. I don't know if I'd call him an influencer, but there's an amazing person online called Ben West, and he talks a lot about mental health. He's a mental health activist. And one thing that he says quite often is, we're all talking about it, but it's about what happens after that actually matters. And I would definitely agree with that. Like, I know that at the beginning of the first lockdown, I was really struggling. I live alone and I'm self-employed, and I was feeling really lost. I lost loads of work and I was very stressed, you know, as you can imagine. And I used to have depression many years ago. I had depression, I had medication for it, and anxiety as well. And the first lockdown just kind of plunged me back into that. And I contacted my doctor and said, I'm really struggling. I don't know how to manage. Maybe I can go back on my antidepressants. And the doctor said, yes, cool. Well, we can't actually prescribe you with the antidepressants because we can't see you in person because of the lockdown. So you just have to wait. But we can put you in touch with these mental health services. So they put me in touch with them, and they called me up and they said, great. So you're on the waiting list. The waiting list is 18 months.
Wow.
And yeah. And that's, you know, I live in Bow in London. And so I could be completely wrong here, so anyone can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the London wait times, in comparison to some of my friends who live in places like Watford or further out, seem to get seen a lot more. But I think that London seems like it might be a bit overwhelmed with mental health requests. And so, you know, I am not an extremely severe case of someone in need. I have a great support network, and I was fortunately able to afford some therapy, which really helped me. But a lot of people aren't in that situation and don't have the luxury of being able to afford therapy. It's extremely expensive. So sitting on an 18-month waiting list, you know, that could actually be the difference between life or death for some people, which obviously is where services like Calm and Mind and all these charities come in. But there's only so much that they can take on. So it's really about what happens after. You know, people can try and express how they feel, but if there's no support, then what happens next? You know, if you have a broken leg, you go to A&E and someone will fix it. But what if you have a broken, not broken mind, but, you know, what if you're in a crisis, a mental health crisis? Why don't we have an A&E for that? Because we know that mental health problems kill people. So for me, it's like shocking. I think about it, you know, almost every week. I'm like, why don't we have an A&E for this or section an A&E for this, you know? But yeah, sorry, I rambled on, didn't I?
Not at all. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I, you know, I've never heard it put across like that, like an A&E for mental health. I think that's absolutely
Absolutely, you know, fantastic way of putting it. Yeah, because I often think as well with mental health, we're told a lot of stuff that's really good for looking after our mental health when it's not in a good place. But everyone is liable to have problems with their mental health. It's very much seen as either something that some people get and some people don't. And there is a bit of an attitude to, it'll never happen to me, you know, but it can, and it can happen at any point. And we're very, very reactive towards it. And maybe some of the things that we do to help mental health, whether it's, you know, meditation and running and exercise and yoga and all these things that, you know, counseling, you know, you don't have to go to counseling just because you're having a bad time. You know, it would be great if we could make these things a bit more commonplace, modern life, rather than just something to do when you're poorly, right?
Definitely. I think the Americans have a great way of like normalizing therapy. You know, my therapist said, and that they're great at it. I think for us, it's still really stigmatized. If you talk about going to a therapist, it's like, whoa, what's wrong with you? But at the end of the day, it's about emotional maintenance, isn't it? Life is stressful. The world is a difficult place to be sometimes. And, you know, especially this year, I mean, we've all been plunged into it. And how, you know, not everyone is able to manage their mental well-being, and not everyone even understands that the kind of the cornerstones of mental wellness, like exercise, like diet, like sleep, because we're actually not taught that at school. No one tells you at school, like, do this. And maybe, I don't know, I haven't been to school in a while, maybe school is changing. But I know why did I need to learn pie? You know, I don't know. I don't even know what it's for. I eat pie. That's all I needed pie for. But instead, why can't we have emotional maintenance taught in schools? Mindfulness. You know, I know that mindfulness actually is coming in a bit more, isn't it? But, you know, I just think that all these things that we should be taught, we're not. And then we get plunged into the world and we have to learn how to cope in this terribly stressful environment. And then what happens is we suffer with mental health problems. And where's the road, you know, where's the guidance for that? There just doesn't seem to be any. Until we put mental health on the same footing as physical health, I don't think that we're ever going to move away from not understanding our own mental health properly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, very much so. It's it's hard, isn't it? Because if you haven't experienced it, it can be difficult to be you know, compassionate and stuff like that. And I think that's hard because you can't see it and it's hard to explain and it's, you know, it's different for everyone and stuff like that. But yeah, if we started at a young age, imagine that, you know, imagine, you know, coming through. Because a lot of, I think, mental health problems are like societal. You know, we've created this society that has us thinking and acting and behaving in a certain way that doesn't really suit us biologically. And we're only now finding that out after decades of living a certain way. It's all kind of bubbling up almost. And we need to kind of change the foundation of society and how we go about things to kind of like flatten the curve, for want of a, you know, a current expression.
True. I remember I used to I spent years working in like the nightclub industry, and in restaurants, like, you know, restaurants and bars and all of that. And these working hours were unbelievable. Like, I would work 14-hour shifts on my feet with no rest in highly stressful environments. I'd get no sleep. I wouldn't eat properly. And, you know, the same goes for on shift. I mean, it's not the same at all, but like on shift doctors or shift workers in general, that is not the best way for us to manage our mental health. You know, we all need that. We all know that, like, disrupting our circadian rhythm has an impact on our hormones and our emotional wellness and, like, yeah, just general well-being. So you're absolutely right. Like, we live in a world that is just not designed for us to be calm all the time. I think what was great for one thing that was good about the lockdown, I think it allowed a lot of us to slow down and get enough rest. And even though perhaps people were dealing with anxiety and financial loss and, you know, unfortunately deaths in their family and so many other things that were going on, I think a lot of people could definitely say, well, you know, I was able to make my own schedule and take days off when I needed days off and make my job work for me. So I really hope we don't lose that
Yeah, it's like lessons from lockdown almost. If it was a book, that's what it could be called. And, you know, there was a lot of jobs and people would say, oh, I need flexible hours to make my life better. Oh, no, you couldn't possibly work from home. And then suddenly, you know, everyone's working from home. And, you know, we found a way around all these things. And, if that works, that could be such a better system, isn't it, to adjust. But how do you manage, Sharifa, your own mental health as well, especially like the modeling side of your work? Because that's, and I might be completely wrong here, but that strikes me as an industry that might be a little bit sort of mentally intensive because of the nature of it and stuff like that. So is that something you have to consider when you're taking jobs and that sort of stuff?
That's a really good question. I don't think anyone has asked me that ever. Like, honestly, I've done a lot of podcasts and a lot of interviews and I honestly don't think anyone's ever asked me that. So I'm a plus size model, and I think as a plus size model, there's definitely a different set of criteria to that traditional model. I know a lot of pressures traditional models have are to keep their weight down or to keep themselves fitting into certain clothes. As a plus size model, you still have similar pressures. You still have to fit the sample sizes because they still do, for some reason, brands still just make the samples in either an 8 or an 18. So you have to fit into that sample size for most brands, and they won't really tend to waive that unless you're shooting a big, massive campaign. And booking big, massive campaigns for most models is not an everyday occurrence. It's kind of a few times a year, if you're really lucky, maybe more. So managing my mental health around modeling has been a journey. I've been modeling for 8 years, nearly 9. And I remember when I first started, I was scouted, actually. So it was never something that I wanted to, never something that I had thought about doing. It wasn't something I was really passionate about. Someone just approached me and said, you should do this. And then I thought more about it. And then I kind of realized that you could make some really good money from it. And also it seemed like an exciting prospect. So I started with my first agency. And I remember my first agency handing me my contract and then saying, right, and now can you please go out and buy yourself a straight hair wig? So
wow,
I went out and I spent £300 on my straight hair wig. It's like from my first paycheck. And I was really heavily encouraged to look more, there's no way to put it really, more white than I am, because I have this thick 4C textured afro. And back then in 2014, brands wanted a mixed race girl or a black girl that has straight hair. So I was encouraged to get rid of my hair. We don't want to see it. We just want you in this wig. And that mentally was probably one of the hardest things I had to deal with as a model, trying to adhere to this Eurocentric beauty standard, which just wasn't how I looked. And then the problem was brands were booking me. I was making money. I was being applauded for these wigs that I was wearing, which were giving me stress bumps and pulling out my hair. And I'd go and get my hair braided so tight because my agent would tell me your wigs need to look flatter, so the braids need to go tighter, that I'd have scabs and my hair would be bleeding underneath, and my wigs would get sewn into the braids. And I was doing all of this because I found an opportunity, a way to make money that wasn't working in restaurants or bars or cleaning toilets. And so, you know, I obviously took that opportunity, but
yeah, sure,
the impact it had on my sense of self and my self-esteem generally, I became really like withdrawn. I struggled to kind of look at myself in the mirror with my natural hair because I would always be told by my agency that I look ugly like that, or that I'm not beautiful. Like, no one wants to see that. Your hair is, I had the worst looker.
They sound horrible. Yeah.
Horrible, really horrible. Amazing agency actually, but just this one particular booker was really quite not very nice, and was not very nice to lots of other girls as well. So I think that was probably one of my biggest mental health challenges, has always been my hair. And it still to this day like is a problem, because people don't know how to style my hair. So very often I'll go to set and be confronted with like everyone else getting their hair styled, and I'm just left to it, or you know, it sounds probably really trivial to people, but when it's your job day in, day out for 8 years, and I'd say, well, 8 years in total, but for nearly 5 years full time, when that's your job and you see that other models are being treated in one way and you get treated another way, that sense of inequality and that sense of being lesser than really can start to eat away at you. So I'm always having to manage my emotions around the fact that people won't style my hair or don't know how to style my hair, styling my hair myself, or having to, you know, when I shop, I probably don't want to name drop. So on one of my bigger jobs, let's say that, when I turned up, all the other girls were getting their hair styled as per usual, but I'd had to go and get my hair braided. And it had taken me half a day the day before. And then in the morning I turned up and it was done. And I didn't get paid any extra for my time, or, you know, obviously they paid for my braids to be put in. But again, it's that sense of like, we won't cater for you. And so I think for me, that's probably been the biggest challenge. And I know that girls who are darker skinned than me deal with it a lot. They deal with not being able to find their shade of foundation, or sorry, not being given the right shade of foundation, so they look ashy, or just things that really shouldn't be happening, but you kind of can't speak up about them because it's your job, and you're very disposable in the industry. If you're going to complain, they'll just get rid of you and find another girl, because there's hundreds of other girls who will be happy to come and sit in your place for £2,000 a day and take that money, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's probably the most challenging thing for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that sounds really heavy, really, really heavy. And I think anything where, you know, so much of, you know, like what you do and you get, you know, you're giving it your time and your energy, and it's kind of based around someone else's opinion of what, you know, of what they want from you, that's really hard. That's really, really hard. I suppose that you, I bet you sort of turn up at jobs almost expecting it. It's almost a bit of like, oh, here we go, like psych yourself up to have to deal with it. Yeah, that's heavy.
Is one of those things where you're very aware that it's not, you're a blank canvas, and it's not about you, it's about the product and it's about the clothes, and you do really have to separate yourself from, this is what I look like in a photo, to this is who I am in real life. And I think you probably see that if you went on my Instagram and you watched any of my Instagram stories. I normally don't look anything like a model, but then I put up a picture which has been highly edited and, you know, has had a team of 10 people standing around in a shoot day that cost £50,000 to put together. And of course I'm going to look excellent. Even I look at pictures of myself and I'm like, God damn, I wish I looked like that. You know, and the reality is I don't, because I don't walk around with my own personal lighting assistant all day long, which is unfortunate, but it's the truth. So you do really have to separate yourself from rejection, from this your little Sasha Fierce alter ego that will kind of crawl out of you on a modeling job and then crawl back in as you get back into the world. We can't, we're not all models, like we are just people, you know.
Yeah, that's it. You know, it might be about the clothes, but you know, yeah, there's a human being wearing them, right?
Yeah.
And you know, one thing that really comes across from your social, Sharifa, is like just in general positivity. You seem to have this real like positive way of looking. You know, it's one of those, and I promise I'm not just saying it because I'm talking to you, but when your little thing comes up on my stories, I always think like, oh, here we go, what's she up to today? Because it's always like you're always dead smiley and that, and it's really cool. But I wanted to ask you about positivity, and I wanted to chat about body positivity as well, because that's something you're a huge promoter of. I'm gonna throw you on your toes a little bit here, but how would you describe the body positivity? Because I think it is massively misunderstood, and I think because of this like social media where we have to say things in characters and we have to, you know, you only get like a minute on an Insta post or whatever, we lose a lot of context. And I think it's really, really important that people get a bit of context and understand what you're talking about when you talk about body positivity.
Yeah, oh, that's a big one. So first of all, thanks for the comment on my Instagram stories. I'm glad that they pop up and you get excited about watching them rather than going, no, I'll skip that. I really appreciate that. And secondly, body positivity is a big topic, in my opinion, because the movement was started by plus size women. Again, anyone can correct me on this, but I believe it was plus size Black women that actually started the body positivity movement. And I feel like I've been involved in this kind of body positive online thing for many years. Lots of my modeling campaigns have involved this body positivity theme. Lots of my posts are very body positive. But I think that the term has been, I think it's been taken, this movement is not only reserved for women of a certain size, but I think that it's been monopolized by women of a certain size and excluded other women and men, and anyone of all genders. And for me, that's really problematic. Because although it's been started by a group of women, plus size women, I think it's really important that we are all able to talk about being body positive at whatever size you are. So being body positive doesn't just mean, you know, only overweight. And I'm going to say overweight very tentatively there, over the medical term, overweight, only over the size or weight that society considers that we should all be. It shouldn't just be only for that group of people. And I think that sometimes a lot of body positive influencers are almost shamed for losing weight, perhaps for their health. You know, I think Lizzo recently was slammed for going on a juice cleanse and promoting diet culture, which is diet culture is definitely a separate topic, but you know, a very well-known model, Robin Lawley, I remember she's one of the world's first ever plus-size models, well-recognizable plus-size models. And I think one of her first big campaigns was Ralph Lauren. And I remember when she lost a bit of weight and all her followers were like, you're giving up on body positivity. But body positive doesn't just mean that. It means to do something that's positive for your body. And if being positive for your body means losing weight, gaining weight, exercising more, whatever it is, body positive should be doing the most positive thing for your body, which doesn't always necessarily mean carrying weight. But that being said, I really feel strongly that women who are plus size need to feel confident and accepted in what is an extremely fat phobic society. So I really support plus size women, and this is why I really like to talk and kind of show my body a little bit on Instagram to have a bit more of a representation of what different body types can look like. You know, I don't have abs. I mean, I think I have some under there if I look for them. But, you know, I do have cellulite. I do have broken veins. I don't have abs. And I do have we call it a perfectly imperfect body, like we all do. And I think that we need to see more of those bodies. But body positivity is for everybody. It's not just for one type of person. Did I repeat myself loads there?
No, not at all. That was a fantastic way of saying it. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, just, you know, we talk of like society and us not fitting into, you know, building a society that doesn't suit us. And, you know, when you talk about weight and how we look and stuff like that, again, we've created a culture, an ideal that doesn't exist. You know, our societal norms aren't normal, right? And that affects people's mental health. It does. If you can't love yourself, you know, and if you can find a place to love yourself, then you can make choices about what you do with yourself, for want of a better expression, you know. But yeah, it's find that positivity in you, right? That peace in yourself.
I really care about people's health and people's mental health. I think because I speak to so many people online and I see how affected people are by certain images that they see. And that's why I'm really careful when I put out content. And I probably don't put out as much content as I'd like to, because I'm always so careful with what I'm putting out, because I know how much of an impact content can have on people, things they're consuming can really have on them. And, you know, knowing that so many men and women, sorry, pardon me, I need to correct myself there, because we are not just men and women. There are different genders. So I'm just going to say so many people. That's a learning curve there, isn't it? Like,
very much so.
Happy for you to keep that in, by the way. I think it's important that you talk about that.
Oh, completely.
You know, so many of us have become, like, not even become, I was raised in a way that I was obsessed with my body. And I think a lot of us have been, because of these images that we've consumed and this beauty standard, which has only typically showed one type of person, which is a thin toned white body. That is what we've been conditioned to believe is the optimal body, and globally as well. Like, you know, that's the global beauty standard is not just even in India, you'd look at big billboards and there's the white faces everywhere.
Wow.
So, you know, I think it's important for us to realize that breaking free from that and having exposure to many different types of beauty is really important for people's sense of self, and because we are all trying to fit into this one cookie cutter idea of what a person should look like, and it's just not true. Like, you go out onto the streets and you will see, especially in London, you will see so many different faces and races and sizes and shapes and heights and skin that has different textures, which we are never exposed to. And I think that's the beauty of social media. You can really curate your feed in a way that you can have access to more different types of people and more representations. But I do think it's really problematic, and I worry for people trying to fit into this ideal. That's absolutely impossible for most of us, you know, yeah. You happen to look that one way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, this idea, we don't really understand what health is. We think of health as being about how you look, but that's, you know, that's ridiculous, isn't it? Really, it's not. I work with a lot of, like, sports people and stuff like that for my day job, and I often say to people who are overtraining and under recovering, I say to people, like, you know, health and fitness are not mutually exclusive. You know, you can be really, really fit and not be very healthy at all. But if you want to be healthy, you have to be a little bit fit, you know, it's just this way of trying to achieve a certain aesthetic. We think that's what healthy looks like. And a lot of people who look like that, they're not very healthy at all, because they're trying to look really hard to look like that. Oh, no, because I was going to chat to you about running as well, Sharifa, because, you know, we talk of health and we talk of body positivity and stuff like that. And, you know, you mentioned we're fed a certain, you know, runners look a certain way, and that's just not true at all. But I think it puts people off doing really helpful things like running, isn't it?
Definitely. The fitness industry for me, in some ways, I'm really grateful that I'm able to work with fitness brands in the way that I do. Working with Sweaty Betty, I've worked with New Balance. I was on the cover of Women's Running Magazine before the marathon last year. And the big response that I always get from this is like, wow, I literally can't believe that I'm seeing a size 18 woman on the cover of a running magazine. This is just, what is going on? But the reality is, when you actually go to these races and you see, you know, half marathons, 10K runs, 5K runs, ultra, I've never been to an ultra, but I've seen the scenes at some ultras, you would be shocked at some of the bodies that you see at these races, because we've been taught to believe, again, like I was saying before, that it's one type of body, that it's the slim, toned, white, mostly, body shape that is the athletic body shape. But you will see people, I've seen women who are way above a size 20 crossing the finish line at half marathon. You know, but because people, it's that whole thing of you can't be what you can't see. And I think there's a huge barrier when it comes to exercise for women of a certain, women and all people of a certain size, because they just think it's, this is not for me. I can't do this because this is only for people that look like that, and it's not for people that look like me. But the fact is that moving your body in any way you can is good for you, and it also builds self-esteem. An amazing author who I absolutely adore, Porna Bell, wrote a book about this recently called Stronger, and she talks all about the barriers to fitness and health and strength that are put in place by these systems, because we are kind of taught to believe that that's not for us. The weights for women, the weight section is not for us, or running a half marathon is not for you because you're not a certain size and you're not an elite athlete. But let me tell you something, I ran a half marathon last year. I thought I was gonna die, but I did it anyway. And I'm so happy to do another one again. And the self-esteem that you build just by taking part in these challenges, it doesn't matter about the time that you do it in. It doesn't matter about any of that. It matters that you took part, but the barriers are there. They're really there. Particularly like I did an open water swim last year as well for the swim serpentine. Terrible swimmer. I did it really slowly. I thought I was going to drown the whole time. but I managed to squeeze myself into one of those lovely wetsuits, which, by the way, are extraordinarily expensive if you want a wetsuit. So that's the first barrier, is money. At so many of these events. And the second barrier is it only went up to a size extra large. And so it just about fit me. I'm thinking, well, what if somebody bigger than me wants to go and try an open water challenge? Where's the equipment for them? Another barrier to swimming that I have is I have an afro. Try and fit a cap on this.
Of course, yeah.
It's such a big problem. And I think I've got an ear infection at the moment. I think because water's been getting in my ears, so I need to get some earplugs. But normally you should be able to put a hat over your ears, shouldn't you, and stop that. I'm not blaming all the swimming app companies for my ear infection, but it's definitely a barrier. And I haven't been swimming this week because I don't have a hat and I don't want to go swimming like this. So the barriers to fitness are unbelievable. And I think they do come from representation. They do come from fitness brands are really setting the narrative for this as well. Like they are the ones that create the clothes just to go and exercise in. If the size is not there, how do we do it? So I think inclusivity overall is just really imperative, especially when we go back to the mental health conversation, especially right now where people, we know moving is great for our mental health. So I think the brands really need to be paying attention to that.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Would you say that running is a good tool for you to use towards maintaining, you know, good mental health and stuff like that?
Definitely. Get a nice pair of shoes and getting a good outfit does cost a little bit of money, but ultimately going out, stepping outside and running down the canal, that's free. So just knowing that I can do that, and setting aside that time and progressing, you know, it's that little sense of done every time you do a run. And I log all of my runs on Strava. And I also, it makes me make better choices with what I'm eating. Like recently, I realized that beetroot juice helps you with your endurance. Fun fact. I read so many scientific studies on this. I'm obsessed with reading and science. And everyone's saying it. So I thought I'd try it. And so far, so good. But also just in terms of what I'm putting into my body and how much I'm hydrating myself, and how much sleep I'm getting. I try when I'm training for a run, I'll make extra, you know, I'll have extra special care to make sure my body has enough electrolytes in it. I'm having my magnesium salt baths for recovery. I'm doing all the things that I need to be doing to be the kind of the best machine that I can be to do the best that I can at my runs. And so even though I don't run fast, and but I do think I run well. I run really slowly, really well. And I, apart from my foot thing at the moment, I generally don't really get many injuries. So, which a lot of people do tend to get injured by going too hard or whatever, again, because I run slowly. So I think it really does build your, it overall is just good for you. To do something good for yourself and your body.
Yeah, definitely. I love that idea of having that one choice helps you to stack a load of other good choices, you know, and that's so true. If I'm training, then I'm doing everything else pretty well. But if I'm not running or I'm not going to gym, then everything else tends to slide, you know. Yeah, that's it, stacking it all together.
Yeah.
And do you have anything else that you use alongside exercise, anything that works for you? Because, you know, I always describe mental health, it's like a personal puzzle, and everyone has to unfortunately find out their own way of building that puzzle. But often when I ask someone that question, you know, something comes up and maybe someone's listening and going, oh, I haven't tried that, I wonder if it would fit in my puzzle, you know. But is there anything that you that works for you, that works for Sharif?
There's lots of things that I've discovered over the years. I think when you come from a place of having, I had quite severe depression, and when I was 17 and attempted suicide as well, in which I was in the hospital for a couple of days afterwards. So my mental health growing up was never very good. Well, it was a work in progress, let's say. Following that suicide attempt, there was lots of other difficult situations, and then depression, and anxiety, and, you know, taking medication for many years. So you do learn to find ways to help yourself as much as possible. So I think yoga was a big one that really helped me to calm down and be able to relax, particularly with my anxiety. At first, it was really difficult to get into yoga because I was so anxious that I couldn't stand still. I couldn't, you know, do any of that. But I started hot yoga. And because it's so bloody hot in there, you just can't think of anything else other than the fact, like, I'm literally going to drop from dehydration right now. So stay hydrated when you go to hot yoga. But I found engaging in really dynamic types of, like, when I say dynamic, like, I find the gym really boring. You go in, you have your little routine. I feel like you need a lot of motivation to get in and have a good gym routine. You need a lot of motivation and a lot of knowledge and a good training plan, which I have managed to get into in the past. But typically, I really prefer just engaging in like an amazing yoga class, a 90-minute hot yoga class, or I love boxing. I'm really into boxing these days. Again, something really like different and keeps your mind focused. Spin, I love spin, any type of exercise that's group based, and it's also that little sense of community, which I think is really important for your mental wellness. So this year has been, obviously we can't really engage in those activities as much this year, but as soon as it all opens up again, I'll be there within a flash, and I think that's always been really helpful for my mental health. I know this, people hear this all the time, but sleep is just such a big one.
It's my number one.
Like medicine, honestly. I don't think that has anyone ever, well, I'm going to ask the audience here, has anyone ever got home from a day at work and thought, oh, I'm so tired, I'm so done, everything's difficult, I've quit my job, my relationship's going badly, and da da da. And then you go to bed, fall asleep, wake up the next day, you're like, today is a great day. I feel fresh. You know, it honestly resets you. The power of a good night's sleep is so underrated. So if you can get yourself into a good, healthy sleep routine, I feel like that is definitely one of my top priorities. It's going to be all the generic ones. Sleep, eating. Well, I mean, I used to be a vegan. I was a vegan 6 years ago. I did it very badly. I had the worst skin. I felt really ill all the time, but I was just eating vegan replacement burgers, and when I couldn't,
Oreos and
Oreos that was and all crisps and everything that I wanted to eat, because I was like, it's vegan. So I failed miserably and thought, I'm never doing that again, give up. But this year I thought, when I saw Veganuary happening again, which is that big kind of, I don't know if you know, it's like an online thing. Veganuary was happening again. I've been reading a lot about the environment and thinking a lot about my choices in lockdown, and thought, I'm going to give it a crack again. So I adopted a whole foods plant-based diet in January, and yeah, it's been 4 months, and I would honestly say I feel better than I felt in a very long time.
Wow.
And again, me being a complete nerd, like I just researched and read everything I possibly could about this. One of my favorite resources for this, the kind of the science behind plant-based diet and your mental wellness and your mental health is the Plant Power Doctor. She has a great book. It's called The Plant Power Doctor, actually. That's the name of her book. There's lots of other amazing resources out there, but talking about a plant-based diet and how basically eating more plants helps to support your mental health and eliminating stuff in our system, which is toxic. It's like poison. Refined foods and alcohol and anything that has more than two syllables in it, like, you know, like the hydrocloxy, you know, you look on the back of so many packets of food, convenience foods that you're eating, and you're thinking, what the hell? My nutritional therapist also helped me with a lot of lifestyle changes, like eliminating plastics from your life can be hugely impactful for your mental health, particularly like heating things up in plastic actually mimics estrogen in your body, which can I've seen the raised eyebrows there. I know, when I first heard this I was like, what? And again, I'm not a scientist or a doctor or anything, so I'm just regurgitating what I've read from several different kind of scientific studies and books and documentaries, and but that, yeah, heating things up in plastic mimics estrogen production, which can again affect your hormones, all of those things. Trying to live a more clean, plant-based, whole foods kind of life, I feel has really impacted my mental health very positively in the last few months.
That's brilliant. I suppose the human body is just one big chemistry set, you know, and you just gotta keep tweaking the levels, right? Yeah. What we put into our mouths, but also what we put into our ears, what we put into our eyes. It's like, it's just all about, you know, consumption being the word, you know, how do we consume and stuff like that. And just, you know.
Oh, before I forget, I will say social media. Social media is a big one. The less time you can spend looking at a screen, the better, I think. But it's been very difficult this year for all of us, but that's a big one.
yeah, social media. It was on my list of notes to chat to you about a little bit, actually, social media. So I'm glad you saved me having to try and weave it in somewhere. But it's hard, isn't it? Because, you know, like myself, I use it for my work. You know, it's quite simple as that. So you have to, it's really hard finding a balance, isn't it, between, you know, that promotion and there are a lot of pluses to social media. There's some really good things, you know. How do you have any, do you have like set boundaries for when you log on and off and all that sort of stuff? How do you work it?
I found it really difficult. I completely agree with you when it comes to using it for work. Obviously, the algorithm is a very clever, very insidious little thing, because the more you put into it, the more you get out of it. And that's how the platform works. You know, when you're not paying for something, when you're not paying for a product, then you are the product. So essentially what Instagram want is our attention, and that's what they're getting by making, you know, by feeding us information that we like to see, you know, by putting us in a little echo chamber of things we're already scrolling and looking at. So I found this year living alone in the pandemic, I found it really difficult to tear myself away from social media. I think also because I used it as a little bit of a lifeline. I made a lot of connections on there, lots of friends. When I caught coronavirus in January, people were checking in on me like as if they were my family members. Oh. And so it was very sweet. Yeah. It was really sweet and lovely. But I would look at my iPhone screen time at the end of the day, and I would have logged 12 hours on social media, you know, living alone with no being self-employed and there's no jobs because there's a lockdown. All I did all day was sit on social media, and I could feel my mental wellness declining. My sleep felt really interrupted. I felt jittery sometimes. It was really quite bad. And I feel that, but I also had the need to keep picking up my phone. So I've had to make a conscious effort to sleep with my phone in a different room, to basically wean myself off my phone as if it's a drug, really. I think there's a couple of documentaries about this on Netflix at the moment, about the addictive qualities of social media. I don't know, I can't remember the references now, sorry. I'm like, there's another documentary. I love a documentary, honestly. But I really think that it is a difficult space to be in. And my ultimate aim is to not be online so much for work. But this year being how it's been, most of my modeling jobs have gone online. Everything's just gone online, hasn't it? So you have to adapt because we all have to pay our bills. But ideally, I would just live in the... I just live in the mountains and log on once a week, say hello, and then go, bye, I'm going off to go and swim in the lakes now.
Yeah, I mean, that just sounds amazing. Yeah, it really does. No, I think it's, I don't know, yeah, it's hard, isn't it? The social media, it's a whole conversation in itself. And yeah, just manage it. I'm the same. My screen time's been through the roof. And as much as there's half of me that's like, oh, I'm just spending too long on social media, and there's other part of me, I really enjoy it sometimes as well. You know, like I like Instagram. If you build the right, you know, if you follow the right accounts, it can be a really nice place to spend a bit of time sometime as well, isn't it? It's just, yeah, but
I have a really nice, I really hate this cliche word community, but I do have the nicest little following of just really interesting and kind. I had some amazing conversations this year with people. It's like, I don't know everyone, but I recognize lots of names, that same names popping up. And I've even made a great friend who is a real life in person, one of my closest friends now. We actually met online in Australia. We bromanced for a couple of years and then we met in person, and now, you know, 3 years down the line, we're still really close friends. So I do think that the power of social media and access to, like I said earlier, access to different types of people that perhaps I often think about myself growing up as a mixed race girl in a town full of white people, and I was the only person that looked like me, and never seeing another person that looked like me on the television or anywhere. And I often think about those young women who might be in the same kind of situation, growing up in a place that doesn't represent them or doesn't reflect them, or they don't feel 100% themselves in, and knowing that they can click onto social media and they can find a person that looks like them and represents something. For me, that's really powerful. And I've had quite a few messages over the years of, mums actually saying, I showed my daughter your Instagram because she wanted to straighten her hair, but then she saw your hair and was like, actually, I really want my hair like Sharifa's, just keep it natural. And for me, that was the most incredible thing, because that's just, you know, a young girl feeling like she can embrace who she truly is just by having that representation. I'm not saying that I'm you know, I'm the best or anything, but I think it's really important that we can try and lead by example, especially for young people. And influencers have a lot of power, actually. It's why I feel quite concerned by the content some of them put out, because I think, well, you probably have 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds following you. But, you know, each to their own, no judgment here, you know. But I think we do have to be really careful and be as responsible as we can.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, that relatability you mentioned, that's huge. And it's the same with mental health. You know, if you're struggling, Francis, and you don't know what's going on with yourself, where are you going to look? You're probably going to look online, you know. And then, you know, the more people out there that are banging the drum, and from, you know, with the podcast, we're trying to speak to just as many different type of people possible, just to kind of show that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether, you know, you've done this or you've done that, or you're this person or that person or anything, man. If you've got a mind, you know, then you need to take care of it. And, you know, we're all human regardless. Yeah, very much so. Well, Sharifa, thank you very much for your time today, mate. That feels like a great place to put a pin on it. I'm quite conscious that I've had you for ages, mate. So, but that was wicked. I really, really enjoyed it. That was brilliant. So thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely. It's been great to have a chat. I could just talk about mental health all day until the cows come home, and until eventually it doesn't have to be a conversation anymore. it can just be something that we're all really aware of and understand well. So thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no worries at all. No, thank you, Sharifa. Thank you.
Listening from the Proper Mental Podcast. Please like and subscribe.
Plus 5 stars.